Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. In the news today, Associated Press reports special counsel Robert Mueller is looking into the connections between President Trump's campaign and the data mining company Cambridge Analytica. Cambridge Analytica is said to have swiped the data of more than 50 million Facebook users to sway elections. The company was financed by major Republican donors. At one point, they employed Steve Bannon, who later became Trump's campaign chief executive. We're going to help you understand what happened at Facebook and what you can do about it. My first guest is computer scientist Jennifer Goldbeck. She's an information studies professor at the University of Maryland. Welcome, Professor.
Glad to be here.
What did Cambridge Analytica do?
So on one hand, they kind of did what a lot of apps do. The data that they got on 50 million Facebook users came from people taking a personality quiz, and I'm sure all the listeners have either taken those or have had friends who take them. Mm-hmm. And in the process of doing that, when people took the quiz, the app that they installed on Facebook grabbed all of their Facebook data, as well as the data for all their friends on Facebook, which apps were allowed to do up until 2015. It was a professor who grabbed that data who then, violating Facebook's terms of use, gave it all to Cambridge Analytica, who used it to find personality traits and other psychological traits of all those Facebook users, millions of them. And that in turn was used to send very personalized, targeted messages trying to get people to vote for Donald Trump, in a lot of cases, sometimes trying to get them not to vote for Clinton, not necessarily that they would vote for Trump, but maybe to just keep them from voting at all.
Could you summarize that or say a little more about how Cambridge Analytica helped Donald Trump?
Yeah. So we're still getting all the details on this, certainly. But what they did is work that actually built up on work that we did here in my lab initially. You can find out lots of things about people from what they post on Facebook, including things that they don't explicitly say. So one thing that we did and Cambridge Analytica then did was to find out personality traits. Are you introverted or extroverted? Are you open to new ideas or closed off? Are you kind of fearful and anxious, or do you tend to be more laid back? And they explicitly talked about this. For example, there's a quote from someone there who said, liberals, they're kind of these absent-minded professor types. They're really open to new ideas, but they don't plan. They're kind of procrastinators and disorganized. And so they built these personality profiles using artificial intelligence and all that Facebook data. And then based on what kind of messages they thought you'd be receptive to, you would see targeted ads on Facebook based around the election to try to get you to vote one way or another.
Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook says that Cambridge Analytica lied to them. He said, "We shouldn't have trusted their certification." Is that really what Facebook did wrong?
It's part of what Facebook did wrong. In one hand, they are in a difficult position here because their rules were violated. I've worked with this data myself in my lab. There's very clear rules about what you're allowed to save and what you can't, who you're allowed to give it to. Those rules were absolutely violated in this case. And Facebook, when they found out this was happening, basically said to Cambridge Analytica, "Certify to us that you deleted the data." And Cambridge Analytica was like, "Totally, we certify that we deleted the data." And it looks like they probably didn't. Is this super surprising? No. I think there's probably hundreds of companies who have stolen users' data in violation of Facebook's terms, just like Cambridge Analytica did. On the other hand, it's sort of hard for Facebook to know if you have a private copy of data you've downloaded and shared it. So on one hand, he's right about that. On the other hand, Facebook was allowing all kinds of apps to collect these huge amounts of data about people and their friends who had not used the apps. Now, they've since made some changes to make that data more private. It looks like they're going to take further steps in that direction. But they're still the company that's allowing a lot of this data to get out there, and that's a problem that he didn't really address in his statement.
How much can companies really tell about me from what I have posted and the personality quiz that I took and what I shared and what I liked on Facebook? This is your business.
So
you've done this.
Yeah, this is exactly the research that I do and that I've been doing for about 5 years. And the answer is we can find out pretty much everything. Demographics like race, religion, gender, sexual orientation, behavioral things like if you drink or smoke or use drugs, we can tell your intelligence, your personality traits, your political leanings. We can predict future things like if your relationship is going to last or if you're going to break up, your risk for developing certain diseases, whether you have conditions like depression, PTSD, if you're suicidal, or, for example, if you're pregnant, if you'll go on to develop postpartum depression. There's research that shows we can predict all of those things just by analyzing little traces left behind on your social media profile. And that's just the academic research that's published. We have no idea what these big companies who have access to a lot more data are able to find out internally. So if you have that data, like Cambridge Analytica did, or like Facebook does, Twitter does, it's massive and powerful what artificial intelligence can find out about you from what seems like kind of weak data.
You have said, Professor Goldbeck, if I'm quoting you correctly, that artificial intelligence can tell whether you're depressed as well as a therapist can?
Yeah, there's really interesting research on depression. Some of it funded by the military, obviously looking at soldiers coming back from war. But some of it, you know, just looking at, average people. And yeah, just by looking at things like your Instagram profile picture, not even looking at stuff you say, but just your profile picture, we can get very accurate diagnoses of depression. The same thing for schizophrenia. Artificial intelligence has been shown to be really good and in some cases as accurate as a therapist. Now, I'm not at all advocating that we replace therapists with AI, but what I am saying is we can get pretty accurate insights about those things, about as accurate as professionals get in one setting.
But how could that be? I mean, literally a therapist who I'm sitting across from who's a trained professional cannot tell my depression level as well. I understand that AI can make some highly educated guesses, but I'm not really following how they're that accurate, super accurate.
Your therapist can definitely get deeper insights into this. But if you sit down with a therapist for one session, get their diagnosis of your depression, this research was comparing to, one session with a therapist determining if you're depressed or not. Hmm. What artificial intelligence looked at was kind of the structure and composition of the photos that you were posting. It turns out that whether it's in text or photos or in behaviors that we do online, a lot of these traits come through. So AI is absolutely making an educated guess. It's going to get things wrong a lot of the time. You know, 20-25% of the time is common. But it's common that if you meet with a therapist one time, they might get it wrong too.
Right.
So it's not really intended to be a replacement, but rather as a tool that could, for example, initially flag someone as like, oh, this person's looking really depressed. They're potentially looking suicidal. We need to get a human involved in this. So it's not AI will replace that therapist, but they can maybe detect some of these early warning signs that then a human can jump in and analyze more deeply.
So we're about to turn to what it's like to love and hate Facebook and what we can do about it. One more question about this information, this highly educated guess about whether I'm depressed. Couldn't a company sell their opinion, using tools like you've created, their AI opinion about whether I'm depressed or addicted or whether I have a medical condition? Couldn't they sell that information to a company that might have hired me for a job, but they're not going to now?
Absolutely. I get queries every week from companies who want me to build those algorithms for them, whether it's depression or helping try to recruit someone away from a company, helping determine, you know, what salary they should get, should they get a loan. Companies are actually looking very actively into doing this. We don't know how much of that's going on behind the scenes. I turn down every one of those offers. In fact, I spend a lot of my time telling companies not to do stuff like that. But the reality is that we can find those things out. This situation you laid out could absolutely happen today. And there's no regulation that really says you can't do that. It's using public data that people are posting that these companies are either pulling directly from social media or that they're buying from data brokers. And you don't have any real rights over those artificial intelligence inferences at this point. I think it's something that we absolutely need to fix. I think, you know, the industry needs to regulate around that, but we probably also need some government regulation because there are all kinds of really scary ways beyond what Cambridge Analytica does that this artificial intelligence could be used that people really wouldn't like and right now they don't have any control over.
This is computer scientist and AI tool builder refusing to go to the dark side, Jennifer Goldbeck from University of Maryland. Okay, stay with us, Professor, please. I want to talk more about what we could do about this. One solution you hear a lot about is delete Facebook. So joining us now is a Seattle musician and writer who hates Facebook, I think, and yet has not deleted it from the stranger, Sean Nelson. Welcome back.
Thank you. Hate is a strong word.
What is it? You seem to loathe Facebook.
I do. I hate it.
Why, briefly?
Because I use it so much, and I feel so weirdly dependent on it, both professionally and emotionally.
Yeah. What is it that... that bothers you, that you could boil down? Because I'm going to ask you why you're still on it, but I want to know what you hate about it.
Let's start with what it brings out in me, is the sort of compulsion to narrate my own existence for the sake of an audience that is either, you know, people I know, I have however many friends I have, but I, you know, some.
You know how many friends you have?
I don't. Okay. I could look it up, but then I'd have to go on Facebook.
Yeah, right.
I of course want to wait until at least this interview's over.
Yeah, but, give it 5 seconds.
Yeah, but that's, I mean, you know, some of them are my actual friends, and some of them are acquaintances, and some are people I vaguely sort of almost know, but probably most of them are people I will never see.
I went to check whether you and I were Facebook friends, because we could have been, and we're not, but it's that, yeah.
I think that's maybe a sign of respect.
Yes, thank you.
It's a mutual respect.
Appreciate that.
So there's that, and then, but I would say that more to the point, the ease of access of it, having it on the phone that is in my hand or pocket all the time. I frequently have, and I wrote this in the piece, but, you know, the number of times in a day that I just have, you know, 2 seconds of what used to be free time or thinking time or, you know, doing nothing time, I instinctively, reflexively go and see what's on Facebook and what's on Twitter and, you know, just to sort of, because it's there. I have had the experience many times of scrolling through Facebook for several minutes, closing it, and then seeing the blue icon for it and reopening it as if I hadn't just, you know, that it seems to have gotten under my skin in a way that is alarming to me. And I don't blame Facebook for that. That's on me. But it's also like, well, it wouldn't be on me if it weren't for Facebook. So.
All things considered, why haven't you hashtag delete Facebook?
Well, it's a good question, and I don't know the answer. I think it's because you feel like you will lose access to all of these people and all of these things that are going on. It's sort of like, I guess it's a stretch to think of Facebook as a party, because it's not the greatest party of all time, but it's like leaving the party. Before the party is over. And so there is some element of, well, what am I going to miss if I don't, you know, what if I never see any of or talk to any of these people ever again? I mean, I mentioned in my piece yesterday that, you know, is it so inconceivable to live without, to just not have Facebook and go back to the world where we have to go search out our own, newspaper and magazine articles, or, you know, promote our shows with flyers or whatever? And that is a certain... That is a voice that I hear in my head about it, like, I remember those days. And though I wouldn't say I was, ecstatic all the time then, it does seem like the things were a little better then. But I don't think you can go back. I think Facebook is in the fabric and almost an indispensable part of living in the world now. And that alone makes me hate it. Even more.
Yes. Well, you just heard Professor Jennifer Goldbeck telling you that AI knows a lot about you. You looked into it, and you decided that Facebook thinks they know you, but they're wrong.
Well, I mean, that was sort of a conceit that, you know, I followed one of the many articles that has been published in the last week that says here's how to delete your account, or here's how to, drastically reduce your footprint, you know, and here's how to rescind all the permissions you have unconsciously or unknowingly given to Facebook to mine your data. And I found the things that they thought I was interested in, there were some of them were right, but there were so many of them, almost, you know, I would say probably 70% of them were like, what? I'm not interested in soccer, you know, or
anime. I think anime was one. Really, you're not though. You'd be a little interested in anime.
I'm not remotely interested in anime. I mean, I have seen some anime films,
yeah,
and they're fine, but it's not something I this is the longest I've ever talked about anime, right here.
They don't call you Sean Anime Nelson.
Sean-a-me. No.
Sean-a-me. Never been said. Was there something just ridiculous that Facebook thinks that you're into?
Extreme sports. But, I mean, I think that could just be because I might have accidentally clicked on something about extreme sports, or I might have mentioned extreme sports in a joke, or who knows, or I might have thought about extreme sports and they knew it.
They knew it.
I was interested in what Jennifer said about AI being more perceptive than the average therapist. I thought it was interesting, but the part that was left out of that conversation is that you don't have to be a therapist, nor do you have to be artificially intelligent to know when people are depressed, because everybody is very happy to volunteer that information. And uh-huh. that's another weird... Facebook invites not only compulsive use, but sort of I have found among a lot of people, and maybe it's just my group of friends, but everybody's very happy, or most people, I guess, are very happy to volunteer very intimate details about their inner lives and their outer lives, but, you know, how they feel and in exchange for people sympathizing or just like saying it because it feels good to say it to someone. And that is a really strange phenomenon, because I've always believed in that kind of like being open about feelings and things like that. But now you're doing it like every time you do it, Mark Zuckerberg gets another nickel or whatever. You know, like that's the weird exchange.
And a company that helps Donald Trump scrapes
right.
scrapes your data.
Right.
Professor Goldbach, she's still here. Professor, what do you think about that idea that your amazing artificial intelligence guessing tools are not that accurate or that necessary? Because we'll just tell you.
Yeah, I mean, in one case, this is totally true, right? If you think about it, so all these algorithms I was telling you about, they're basically, like, under the hood, the math is the same as, like, what Netflix uses to recommend movies or Amazon uses to recommend products. And if you think about those, like, a lot of the time they're right, but they're not super insightful, right? Like, you buy the latest Stephen King book, and it recommends 10 more Stephen King books,
right.
Like, no AI necessary. Sometimes, and I mean, a decent percentage of the time, like I said, 20% of the time, it gets it completely wrong. But sometimes it gives you these great moments of insight. There are, you know, I think it's right. Tons of people will tell you that they're depressed on social media, but there's also people who won't. You know, sometimes because they just want to keep it private,
sure.
Sometimes because they're ashamed and they won't ask for help. And in cases like that, you know, some kind of tool that could give you some help could be useful. But I agree. I don't think it's like all the time AI is giving us these deep secret insights that humans couldn't figure out. A lot of times humans do way better than the AI does.
But even the harvesting of that information and then the analysis of that aggregated information, that seems to be where the real nefarious thing is going on.
100% agree.
So, Professor, let's say that Sean Nelson wants to make the world a little better place. He hate loves Facebook, or not even loves, but it just is. What could Sean do, and would it change the world?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what I did. And because Sean, you know, I read your article and I was just like, I felt like you were a little too in my brain with a lot of it. We have very similar feelings.
I just need some AI to get in there.
Yeah, and you know, like, I build this artificial intelligence, but I do it in ways where every user is explicitly consenting and knows what they're doing. But I'm really creeped out by people running it on me without my permission. So what I've done is not delete my Facebook profile, but I delete everything from my Facebook page. I actually did it by hand a couple years ago. It took me like 2 weeks, 8 hours a day, full time. I deleted everything I had ever done. Now there are automated tools. So I use one called Facebook Timeline Cleaner. It's a browser plugin. You can let it run overnight, and it will basically delete everything older than some time you specify. So every couple weeks I run it and I get rid of anything that's more than 2 weeks old. So it deletes all my posts, all my photos. If you are really attached to those things you've put on Facebook, there's an option in your settings where you can download a private archive to your computer.
Yeah.
You have it. But none of those algorithms work on me. Like, I try them all the time and they say they don't have enough data. So it's one way that you can keep a lot of this private. Now, that won't protect you against places like Cambridge Analytica and these other apps who have already harvested your data, but it means going forward there's a lot less of that there.
Right.
What do you think, Sean?
I mean, I haven't used that particular tool, but I've done a similar thing. And, of course, I was struck by how incredibly I guess it's not difficult, but it's so unbelievably tedious to do it. You really do have to kind of go in and, you know, I mean, like deleting all of the things it thought I was interested in, which I did because, you know, some journalist at a blog said that was what you do. It made it clear to me that this idea that Facebook was somehow, you know, guilelessly unaware that, we had no idea that this data could be used for ill. Like, it just made it seem very clear to me that, I mean, obviously, surveillance is their business model. It is how they get, that's how they get their chokehold on all the advertising. And it just seems disingenuous for them to suggest that this is like an unintended consequences that they got busted.
That suggests a couple of questions for Professor Goldbeck. Isn't data the business model for so many businesses? In other words, if we all deleted Facebook and Cambridge Analytica were out of business, would the world become a place where we will no longer have our data mined?
Yeah, totally not. It's the business of lots of other places, and not just social media. So, you know, one story that I tell a lot comes from a New York Times article from like 2012, where Target computes pregnancy scores, they call them pregnancy scores, for all their female customers that can tell if they're pregnant and, if so, what their due date is. They found out some 15-year-old was pregnant before she told anybody she was pregnant. And they don't do that with social media. They do that with your purchase history, right? They put all the stuff you've ever bought in the context of all the millions of people whose purchase histories they have.
And it's not just that she had bought, baby clothes. It was that she had bought vitamins, right?
Handbag and vitamins. Like it's these weird statistical connections that you can find when you have huge amounts of data that logically don't make any sense, which also means you can't hide from the algorithms. You can't keep it secret because you don't know what little things they're going to pick up on. And look, whether it's Target or someplace else, you can buy a lot of people's purchase histories on the data broker market. You can buy huge amounts of data. So even if you get off all social media, which does come with a lot of downsides, unless you go completely off the grid, you are going to be data mined. And if you do go completely off the grid, you start to look like a terrorist and people are going to start paying a lot more attention to you.
I hadn't thought of that.
May I ask a question?
Yeah,
Professor Goldbeck, there have been sort of Cassandras all along for years now saying this is all a data mining, scam. These are the things you're unconsciously giving up. And people, I think, vaguely knew or vaguely understood, but because they didn't understand or we didn't understand how it worked, they were able to kind of, ignore it or, pretend they didn't know. Do you have a sense of why people were able to do that? What made us all sort of ignore this thing that we kind of all knew about for a long time?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I feel like I have been that Cassandra. Like, I professionally go around and talk about this stuff and warn people about it for years, and they still don't know a lot of this stuff that I've talked about. And I think a lot of it is that, on one hand, you've never seen it really happen to you. Like, I think that's why this Cambridge Analytica thing is really blowing up as a story, because people have seen these ads. They have seen, if not themselves, other people get these kind of targeted messages, and so it feels a little more personal. But I think another problem, which gets to this whole conversation we're having, is that if you feel really powerless, like, what are you going to do about it, right? Mm-hmm. We're not going to completely get off social media because, sure, we can go back to that time. But, like, as someone who kind of grew up without social media as an undergrad, and then it kind of came about when I was in grad school, there are people that I lost touch with, family members, high school friends, who I really cared about, but I wasn't writing the letters, I wasn't making the phone calls, and now it allows me that kind of contact. I think giving that up and giving up those internet friends and that support, that's a hard thing to do, and we don't want to get rid of that. But then we feel like, well, okay, so they're data mining me, I don't like it, but the cost of giving it up is so high, I don't feel like I can do anything, so I'm just going to ignore it.
Right.
Hopefully this gets us to a place where we do something about it.
Two questions, Professor. Is there an app that would tell me, before you send that, before you share that, like that, click on that, here's how it could be used in a way you might not like? Some kind of warning system, AI that knows about AI?
It would be great. I have tried to make this project a few times. The problem is that we don't really know, right? So we can sort of say, oh, here are the algorithms we know about that are using that thing to figure this out, but there's new ones being invented. I mean, literally every month I read about a new one. In the other hand, I can give you a really simple thing. Anything you post, whether it's a photo or a piece of text or a like or a comment, is going to be mined and analyzed.
Okay.
I mean, Facebook even looks at stuff like if you're typing a reply or a post and you don't post it, like you start typing and then you just backspace over it, mm-hmm. they keep track of that stuff that you typed in the box even though you didn't post it, right?
Wow.
Anything you do, like they'll keep track of how many seconds you looked at a post if you're scrolling through, and they use that to show you more even if you don't click on it. Any interaction you take, like vaguely near a social media site, is going to be analyzed in mind and used to try to extract value out of you.
Okay, then one more. My guest is Professor Jennifer Cassandra Golbeck from University of Maryland. How about could we try again? So now we know that Facebook it shares our data, and we know how annoying it is. We've talked about how vapid and all that Facebook is. So could we try again now with a new social network that is? Could we do better? Next.
Yeah, we could. And so here's a startup idea for all of your people who want to do one. I'm happy to come on as a consultant.
Uh-huh.
Here's the reason that hasn't happened. Because all our friends are on Facebook, right? So there are plenty of alternatives out there that are better, nicer, have great user experiences. I try them all. There's lots of them out there. But nobody switches to them because there's nobody there, right? You have like one friend on Elo, and like what use is it, right? So I think if we were to try to start again, we'd come up with something that's good and ethical and nice. And then what you would need is a way that people could easily export everything they've done on Facebook, which you can do, import that into the new social network. So I take my local copy, and now I've got all my old posts, all my photos, and that allows me to bring my friends over. So I can sign up for this site. It knows who all my friends were on Facebook, and then when they come to the new site, I immediately am connected to them again. I don't have to go through and find them as they come in. Technologically, this is doable. And so I think if you had, you know, a company that had enough venture capital backing, that had the power to do it, and had some good user experience engineers that could make it very simple for people to switch over, there's an opportunity out there to do it. But all the competitors that we've seen, whether it's something big like Google+ or some startups, haven't allowed people to bring over those social connections, which are really the main thing of value that we have on Facebook. And so if we can find a way to do that well, I could see a competitor. But, you know, that hasn't happened in the 10 years that I've been suggesting maybe it could happen. So we'll see if it comes about.
But also all the people who develop and market that network would have to find some other way of making it profitable, right? Because isn't the whole thing that Facebook's money comes directly from harvesting your data?
It does, and that's the challenge, right? Like I was talking to my husband about this. Like you could run a nonprofit social network, right? Get like the Society for Social Good makes a nonprofit social network, no monitoring, limited advertising, but there'd have to be some way that they have the money to fund those operations. The data warehouses, the computational power to run something like Facebook is huge. It costs a lot of money to run Facebook, independent of all their business operations, and so. You know, how do we do that? How do we make it not regressive, right? You don't want to keep poor people off your platform. That's a challenge, and that's one that we have not figured out really in the whole online space in 20 years, is how do you make money other than advertising and taking advantage of people's data? So that part will definitely take some creative thinking. And look, I think there's ways that you can ethically advertise. Like, I like a good targeted advertisement if it gives me some value, right?
Mm-hmm,
I'm happy
sure.
to give some data over. You know, maybe it's marketplace stuff. You know, Facebook certainly has that, but there can be ways to make money. I'm not a business person, so I don't know how to balance out what kind of income that gives you over what it costs to run the network. But
not a business person, but she is a computer scientist. Professor Jennifer Golbeck builds AI tools. You still do it, right? That can know about you.
Yeah, we're still doing
still
it and
doing
finding
it.
Out lots of creepy stuff.
Yes, I want to know more. Please come back. Information Studies Professor, University of Maryland. Thank you, Professor Golbeck.
Thanks so much.
So, Sean Nelson,
yes.
Are you going to use that delete after 2 weeks app? Are you going to delete Facebook completely?
I would like to think that I will one day, but I'm just, I mean, I am not there yet. That's the thing. It is really, it is a real conflict with me because I do like it and I do deplore it, you know, and that's, and I have had a lot of responses to the thing I wrote yesterday saying that people relate to that, that conflict. And that, I mean, and I've seen it all along. I mean, you, if you, you don't need to read too far or too long before you see someone saying, God, I hate how much I use this thing. And even she mentioned, Professor Goldbeck mentioned Elo, and, you know, every once in a while, there's—
That's the nice social network.
Right. Yeah. A new one comes along and everyone's like, all right, finally we get to get out of here. It is like, it feels like, you know, there's a great— this is very far afield, but there's a great bit in the movie My Dinner with Andre, which is one of my very favorite films, in which Andre Gregory talks about how cities are, especially New York City, are sort of like these prisons that the inmates build themselves.
Right.
And that there is an element of that to Facebook. And I also think that that's part of why we've been able to allow ourselves to ignore the knowledge that the data is being mined and used to our you know, to ill effect on us, because we feel kind of anonymous and kind of isolated. And so we think, well, surely my data isn't going to matter to anybody. Yeah. And then it just kind of goes on like that.
All right. I hear Sean Nelson is not ready to delete Facebook. Otherwise, how would you know which Golden Girl you are? I mean, there's a lot at stake.
Well, yes. I mean, obviously, I'm obviously B. Arthur, but I didn't need Facebook to tell me that.
And now we all know. Sean Nelson from The Stranger, writer, musician, really good article at The Stranger on this dilemma that a lot of us face. And thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. Brotopia, Silicon Valley for sure. What about Seattle? We'll talk about that in a moment. Eat, do drugs, have sex, repeat. That's how Bloomberg's Emily Chang describes the party culture in Silicon Valley in her new book, Brotopia. She describes investors, founders, managers, employees meeting at lavish homes, taking ecstasy or Molly, and making deals in hot tubs. But Emily Chang and another tech veteran, former Amazon employee Christy Coulter, say that bros gone wild, that's just a piece of an aggressive and misogynistic work culture that shuts women out of the booming tech industry.
You know, it's not as dramatic as a sex party, but I do, in the book, visit a strip club. And this is a club in the middle of the startup district of San Francisco, where on a Friday afternoon, there's a line out the door at 11:45 a.m. for lunch. And it's an all-you-can-eat buffet with topless entertainment. And you have tech executives coming from all over the city of San Francisco, and most of them are groups of men who look like they work at tech companies. And I interviewed women who work at the club, and it's the same thing. You know, one of the women who worked there told me she would often, you know, see groups of men come in. They'll talk about, hey, they're, oh, that's my boss, or we're doing a deal, or, you know, an executive will come through the door that everybody knows and people surround them, or they might all go up to a private room together. I mean, I was shocked that this was happening.
And prevalent. You quote people saying, it's weird if you don't go to this. That's the part that surprised me.
And if you're the one woman on that team and you're not coming along, you know it's Friday. You know where all your coworkers are. You're in a meeting with them later. I mean, that's just, that has to feel really, really strange.
You know, I had women who work at Uber who were invited to strip clubs and bondage clubs in the middle of the day. And, you know, in no world should that be part of a typical workday, or should anyone, man or woman, feel pressured to engage there? But if you don't go, you're thinking, what are the conversations that I'm going to miss out on? What, you know, project is someone going to get assigned to? You know, could I miss out on this new feature that I want to work on, you know, because I'm not one of the guys? These things happen in less extreme situations every single day because so much business in Silicon Valley gets done outside the office.
So then this is what I want to know is where's the change coming from? Are we looking to the law or to Me Too whistleblowers or to cultural commentators or to tech executives?
all of the above,
in my opinion. Take the help from anywhere.
I think
ultimately this has to start with the CEO. If you were to have not one woman, but let's say half the women saying, gosh, I don't know if maybe we shouldn't go to a bondage club at 2 p.m. for our team meeting. It's safe for 3 women out of 6 to say that. And maybe no one will even bring it up. Suddenly, the meeting is in an appropriate meeting space. For me, it all is going to come down to having women in the room so they can not police men's morals, because God knows I'm tired of that. I'm not doing that anymore. But to sort of help them understand what's inclusive and what's not, and to demand it, frankly.
Emily, Christy just suggested that she's sick of policing men's morals. Do you see that as a dead end?
I don't think we need to be policing morality, but some things are not acceptable in the workplace, you know, moral or not. I mean, we should not be going to strip clubs in the middle of the day. You know, I think there's an interesting conversation to have about alcohol and how often it is in the workplace. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe it's just Friday happy hour, or maybe companies mm-hmm. decide they don't want that. I do think that writing down your values as a company is really important, and that needs to start early. And, you know, Uber's values were stepping on toes and always be hustling. Those values didn't quite work out for them. Even at big companies, I sort of walked into this thinking startups must be so much worse than big mm-hmm. companies because they have these established HR systems, et cetera. What I found in talking to women is that it really depends on your manager. And if you get a good manager, you know, you can have an amazing experience. But if you get a bad manager, whether you're at a small company or a big company, you can be, you know, essentially marginalized and have a horrible experience. And, you know, the women that I talk to, because they're the only woman in the room hour after hour after hour, meeting after meeting, it's exhausting and very frustrating at times because they feel like they have to prove themselves over and over again. Like it's this entire second job, this emotional labor that men just simply don't have to do.
Mm-hmm. I did find that. I found that I used to say I was trying to be the exact right amount female. If you are too masculine, it makes men uncomfortable and they think you're too aggressive or something. And if you're too feminine, then you're not being aggressive enough. Amazon really prizes, you know, having backbone and disagreeing productively and that kind of thing. And it's a really tricky balance to strike because that's a behavior that's rewarded in men and women are often punished for. And yet it's encoded in the company's core values. So there is emotional labor is the right way to put it. There is a lot of extra work that you have to do just to stay even.
Is there anything that can be done about that reaction to words like having backbone and, you know, stereotypes of who's a leader and who isn't?
You know, it's interesting because that's exactly the same thing that people who have worked at Google for many years have told me. It's a culture that prizes confidence and confrontation and a willingness to debate ideas. And some people, men and women, aren't comfortable in that environment. And what many employees at Google told me, I wish we were rewarded more based on results and not approach, mm-hmm. because what it means to be a leader can be very different in different situations. And I interviewed Sheryl Sandberg and Susan Wojcicki and Marissa Meyer, all, you know, women who rose up through Google and brought different styles of management to the table. And many of the employees that I talked to who worked for them really appreciated that management style. And so I just think it's so important, not just for these companies and the cultures that they are creating, but for all of the people who use these products, to have people from all backgrounds making them. Because Silicon Valley, whether you're at Google or Amazon or Microsoft, is changing our lives every single day. Billions of people are using these products, men and women. And we need all backgrounds to be represented, or this discrimination and all of our biases, because we all have biases, is going to get rewritten into the algorithms, AI, machine learning of the future. I mean, face ID and facial recognition technology, for example, there's evidence that it, in a way, is racist and sexist, that it doesn't necessarily recognize women and people of color the same way it recognizes white men. And I think there are so many interesting examples like that. I interviewed Ev Williams, the co-founder of Twitter, who told me he thinks that if women had been on the founding team, that maybe online harassment and trolling wouldn't be such a problem.
What could have been done differently?
Well, just think about the way that the product is designed. They were thinking about wonderful and amazing things that could be done with Twitter, not how it could be used to send rape threats or death threats. You know, they really wanted to create an open platform where anyone could contact anyone. Well, think about the behavior that has fostered. And maybe a woman on the team might say, I don't know if I really want to hear from anonymous Joe Schmo. And having been on the receiving end of trolling, I might echo that. And I
Aren't there platforms like that? Aren't there alternatives to Twitter if that's can be popular or more popular?
Well, Twitter kind of owns the game now, and I think women probably could find other platforms, but then we're going to be missing out on the audience. I think what Emily's saying is if women are in the room, we can help to build the product in a way that it works for all of humanity, not half of humanity.
How can we assess results, given our lizard brains, results without assessing the, as you put it, the approach? I mean, is there a model industry where somehow people are evaluated objectively in a some results-only way and our biases don't creep in?
You know, it's interesting. I can't tell you how many times as I was writing this book that people said to me, well, Silicon Valley can't possibly be worse than Wall Street. Well, in fact, it is worse than Wall Street when you look at the numbers. Wall Street, the top banks, are actually 50-50 across the board. They have a lot of work to do when it comes to women in leadership positions. But, you know, this is an industry that had a reckoning in the 80s and 90s, which, you know, I think that's certainly a good example. Things can change. And I'm an advocate that it is not too late. The people who are changing the world can change this, too. But there are several industries like medicine and the law that have, you know, essentially opened their doors to women. And now, at least in medicine, you have women accounting for more than 50% of doctors, which was not the case in the 1970s. And what's fascinating about technology and computer science is that women were there. In 1984, women were earning 37% of computer science degrees. That number has plunged and it's been flat at about 18% for the last decade. And jobs have had a similar trajectory. There is no other major that has such a staggering gender disparity. I think if you go to math, it's about 40% female. So there is so much work that the tech industry has to do. But I say, you know, if you're taking us to Mars and building self-driving cars and, you know, you're changing the way we shop, the way we communicate, it's not too hard to hire more women and pay them fairly.
And keep them. I think that when I've had conversations with very well-meaning men about this, what they often go to right away is, oh, the pipeline. We've got to teach, you know, girls who are 6 years old right now to code so they can come work for us. And then they sort of smile like, solved it. And it's But what's happening is women are coming into the profession and then they're leaving. So unless we're dealing with that unwanted attrition and making it a place where women can feel comfortable and can grow and can stay, then it's almost immoral to keep stuffing the pipeline at some point.
It is the common refrain that, you know, it's the pipeline problem. We're trying. We can't find them. They don't apply. And, you know, I argue in the book for a lot of reasons that the tech industry created the pipeline problem by having such a narrow idea of who can do this job and perpetuating the stereotype of the antisocial, mostly white male nerd. But even when you look at the women who already are in the industry, women are twice as likely to quit a job in tech as men are, and they're not going home to take care of their families. They're going to jobs in other fields. They're 800% more likely to leave a job in tech than women are to leave jobs in other fields.
What has the Me Too, the hashtag Me Too movement, done, if anything, to Silicon Valley culture? And I would ask the same about Seattle. Mm-hmm.
It has been catalytic in Silicon Valley, but I think we need to keep the momentum up. I mean, I actually think the Me Too movement started in Silicon Valley as far back as Ellen Pao, who sued her venture capital firm Kleiner Perkins for gender discrimination in 2012. She lost in court, but in a way, I think she won in the court of public opinion. And over the years, a lot more people, at least sort of anecdotally, I think, now understand what she was trying to say. Then we had Susan Fowler come forward, who was an engineer at Uber.
At Uber.
Who, you know, wrote this viral blog post about being propositioned by her male manager for sex her very first day on the job. She took screenshots of it, showed it to HR, and thought to herself, oh, open and shut case. I have evidence. And they told her, we're going to let that slide because he's a high performer. And subsequent to that, there have been several women who've come forward about investors and executives in Silicon Valley, and a number of people have been exposed, but it hasn't risen to the level of sort of national attention like Harvey Weinstein or some of the politicians we've heard about, or even some of the men in media. You know, I do think that's in part because, you know, we don't have a Reese Witherspoon or somebody who can advocate for women in tech at the Golden Globes, you know, but also all of these women are, you know, sign NDAs to work at these companies. And it, in a way, it's taking a vow of silence. And so it's a very risky proposition still, even in this climate, to come forward.
Mm-hmm. And I would say in Seattle, what I've seen is mostly just that women are talking. I wouldn't say that I saw any particular response or change at the corporate level at Amazon when I was there. These things also sometimes take time to play out. There may very well be terrific things going on behind the scenes. But women started talking. I didn't see as many of the really terrifying stories that I saw coming from other places. But the conversation spread from sexual assault or sexual harassment to just microaggressions. Suddenly, the floodgates opened and women were saying, oh, I get interrupted in meetings every day. People won't make eye contact with me. I was passed over promotion for being too aggressive. It was like everybody just stopped pretending everything was fine and started talking. And it was both really, you know, kind of upsetting and really thrilling at the same time. And I hope that's still going on.
Yeah. I see the conversations happening and I just hope it leads to action, mm-hmm. right? Because in a way, it's become safer than ever to just have a mm-hmm. discussion about it. But let's make sure it's not just talk and there's action that follows up.
So, Christy, you were saying Seattle is a more mature tech market as far as big companies versus startups. How excluded are women or not in Seattle's mm-hmm. different tech environment?
I tended to feel a more benign type of exclusion. I think partly I chose my roles and my managers very well in my career at Amazon. And so I generally worked for people who I thought really cared about me and advocated for me. At the same time, I was often the only woman in the room. And there's just a sense that you don't quite belong. It didn't feel overwhelming or systemic, but there's just a sense that you're just not quite with the other people. It's subtle, and because it's subtle, you can start to feel like you're crazy.
Right, you question yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it me? Is it them? Am I missing something?
Yeah. Amazon, especially being very data-driven, there's this idea that data can't have a bias, that data is gender neutral, and that's simply not true. You know, what are you measuring? How are you measuring it? What do you weight over other things? This all has to be looked at with the idea that bias may be unconscious. It's not that people are trying to be malicious or discriminatory, but it's just inherent in our brains.
And I make this point in the last chapter of my book that, you know, there's a lot of unconscious bias training happening now. And, mm-hmm. you know, every company knows that they have to do it. But if we just focus on raising awareness about bias, that won't necessarily have a lot of impact. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to say to someone, okay, change the way you think about women. We all have biases. But if you give people tools to combat their bias, that can have a lot of mm-hmm. impact. So, you know, maybe it's not even starting an interview process until you have at least one or two qualified female candidates or people of color. That may require some more patience, but it will pay off.
You see that happening? Is that realistic for the tech industry?
I do, absolutely. And I think that's really important. You know, we need to wait and see how these processes mm-hmm. bear out and if better hires or, you know, more diverse hires are reflected in the results. Diversifying recruiting teams, you know, building structured review and feedback systems into a company. I mean, simply the way we evaluate people, the language we use can be very gendered. I say pay people fairly. The pay gap in Silicon Valley is 5 times the national average. For an industry that loves data, let's look at the data. These companies make so much money. Can't they just pay men and women the same thing if they're doing the same job? And, you know, that's so important just to make people feel valued. And we all want to feel valued. We all want to feel like we belong. And, you know, it's not going to happen if people aren't getting paid what they deserve.
Emily, you suggested that Silicon Valley can change the situation. Do they want to? Do the leaders, the tech leaders, they want to?
I think a lot of people do want change, but it's more than having good intentions. And, you know, we've heard so many people talk about it for so long that we need to follow some of those good intentions up with good action. And, you know, I do believe that people are starting to realize that this isn't just the right thing to do. This is the smart thing to do. I mean, there is loads of research that proves that, you know, diverse teams make better decisions. Diverse teams are more innovative. There's a study by the IMF that found that if you simply add a woman to a board or a woman to an executive team, profitability goes up by 3-8%. We need to be talking about these numbers and, you know, to realize that, you know, this isn't just the right thing to do, which I believe it is. This is the smart thing to do if you are building a business and building products for the world.
Emily Chang is the anchor and executive producer of Bloomberg Technology, and her new book is Brotopia, Breaking Up the Boys Club of Silicon Valley. And Christy Coulter is a Seattle writer, former Amazon employee, and author of the upcoming book, Nothing Good Can Come From This. Listeners, I suspect some of you work or have worked in the tech industry here. Does this sound familiar? Or have you had a really different experience in the Seattle tech market? Maybe you think tech companies don't need a culture change. We'd like to know either way. Write to us at record@kuow.org, record@kuow.org, or tweet us at KUOW. It's The Record on KOW. Glad you've been listening today. There's finally a new show on TV that is set in Seattle. It's not totally new. It's a spinoff of Grey's Anatomy, which was set in a fictional Seattle hospital. And how do people end up in the hospital? Well, sometimes they get trapped in fires. And sometimes good-looking firefighters are there to help.
I do this job because I love it. Every fire put out, every life saved. We're Seattle firefighters.
The show's called Station 19, and it premieres tonight on ABC. Let's check the early reviews, judging by the headlines I see online. Grey's Anatomy firefighter spinoff lacks heat. Grey's Anatomy spinoff doesn't ignite. Station 19 premiere may make you want to scream fire to escape. That's actually kind of fun. How about, hey, Station 19, please add fuel to this fire. Station 19, earth, wind, and boring. Come on, baby, write my fire better than you wrote this. Okay, you can probably do better. Feel free to tweet us your Station 19 review at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for listening. The show is made for you by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jimabrempong, Jason Pagano, social media producer Bree Ripley, and Kara McDermott. And tomorrow, it's the Week in Review, this week with Sydney Brownstone, Joni Balter, and Eric Liu. We're going to catch you up, get you smart about this week's news. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in.